Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. You know, we're all worried about the state of the world, be it increasing tensions in the Middle East or perhaps an over-leveraged, too-big-to-fail banking system that is actually larger today than it was before the crisis of 2008. Or maybe we note depletion of basic resources with none more basic than fresh groundwater. Or maybe politicians and central bankers the world over intent on ignoring the lessons of the past while slavishly struggling to create more growth in debt instruments and hopefully the economy too. With a lot of luck, they may even succeed. For a while. But we all know this. The path we are on is unsustainable, which means it will someday stop. With a lot of luck, this will happen on our own terms. Far more likely, however, things will stop on some other terms. Perhaps nature's, or maybe the way all bubbles burst, through some collection of minor insults that shift the winds and tip the boat. Who knows? Well, nobody knows, and that's the point. And neither can we know which of many scenarios will actually play out. Will the period of adjustment be gradual and gentle enough to give us all time to reorient our lives and systems without major disruption? Maybe. But it might also be a more rapid, paralyzing, and disruptive transition, more akin to falling off a ladder than climbing down. Just like anybody, I run all the various scenarios through my mind and try to tune my daily preparation and actions to optimize my current happiness and future resilience. To help us explore what a quick trip down the ladder might entail, today we welcome James Wesley Rawls as our guest. Jim, a former U.S. Army intelligence officer, is the proprietor of SurvivalBlog.com and author of several books, including the best-selling Patriot novel series, which I've read and enjoyed. With a background like that, it's little surprise that he's a leading expert in survival tactics and developing self-sufficiency. For those interested in learning how to become less dependent on the system, Jim is a true font of practical knowledge. Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Let's begin by going a little bit deeper into your background and the practical expertise that's helped you develop.
Well, as you mentioned, I'm a former Army intelligence officer. And when I was in an Army intelligence, it really gave me some exposure by way of country studies and a lot of classified reports. It gave me some exposure to just how fragile national infrastructures can be. And in reading through those country studies, I came to the realization that our own nation is actually quite fragile. We have incredibly long chains of supply. We're becoming increasingly technologically dependent with every passing year. And we have a pampered society that is not used to doing things for themselves. And we've essentially built ourselves a house of cards. When things do fall apart, I think they'll be quite traumatic.
Well, now, what are some of the triggers that are on your radar screen for reasons that might happen? Do you think it's just that technology fails because it becomes too complex? Is it maybe a coronal mass ejection, which we talked to somebody recently?
Yeah, that's actually one of the ones near the top of my list would be an X-class solar flare.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's also the risk of a hacker attack on the SCADA software that controls the power grid and utilities and oil refineries, for example. There's always the risk of a global pandemic, which would keep people at home and away from their jobs at the utilities, and we could see the power grid fail for that reason. And, of course, there's always the risk of an economic collapse, and I think the current risk is quite high presently since we have central bankers that are attempting to reinflate a bubble when they really shouldn't. And if there's a economic collapse, I think that things could become so traumatic in the big cities so quickly that just like with a pandemic, utility workers are going to be afraid to leave their homes to get to work. And with the way the NRC regulations are written right now, unless a nuclear power plant has a certain level of staffing, it has to shut down by law.
Well, this idea of having a grid shutdown, that's come up several times so far. Is this at the top of your list of concerns?
Well, I think that the power grids, and there's three of them, are the real linchpins of modern society. There's three grids in the United States, an eastern grid, a western grid, and a Texas grid. We have so much that depends upon the grid that without them, I think that we would see our society devolve into chaos very quickly. We're dependent on the grid for telecommunications, for reordering systems for all the grocery stores, for example, and they've all switched over to just-in-time inventory control. So their inventories are razor thin. We're dependent on power grid for the banking system. And even the way that businesses operate is dependent upon grid power, not just for the cash registers, but if you look at modern commercial architecture, for the last 30 years, it's been very much geared toward concrete slab tilt-up architecture, what you see in your typical big box stores. And these are essentially windowless buildings that will be completely untenable if the power grids go down. There's not enough natural light, not enough natural ventilation. Essentially, they're going to be big, dark caves.
Well, poorly ventilated caves, too, at that.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, they're either going to be freezing cold caves in the northern climates or hot, humid caves in the southern climates. It's not a very enviable kind of situation. I don't think that most businesses are going to be able to revert to 1950s-style commerce. Even if they wanted to run a manual cash till, most stores are not set up to handle that at all.
Well, have you been tracking at all what's been happening? And I consider Greece to be in a capital D depression, and they've certainly been suffering, and they've got well over 50% unemployment in the youth and pieces like that. Have you looked at what's been going on in their society and how they've been coping?
Sure. In fact, if anything, Greece is an example for us. It's kind of a preview of what a slow slide scenario would look like. I think here in the States, we won't even have the benefit of a slow slide because Greece is in a lot of ways still a very traditional society. It has a fairly homogeneous population. It still has a fairly high percentage of people that live off the land, either fishing or in small agriculture. In the United States, you've got 1% of the population feeding the other 99%.
Mm-hmm.
And if we see problems in the United States, I think they're going to happen much more quickly. Things come unraveled practically overnight. And again, the linchpin will be the power grid.
Well, it's interesting to me that in nature, the idea of resilience comes about with you know, the ability to withstand a shock of some kind. We have a very cost-effective society. Walmart is very, very cost-effective, but the point you're making here is that it's not resilient. It's,
exactly.
Not even just the long supply chains, but there's so many interlocking pieces. For Walmart to run, what do you need? You need the grid because they only do point of sale, electronic debits for the most part. They're not tuned to run on cash anyway, but even if they were, they're relying on nightly resupplies and a nationally coordinated, inventory control system to even know which trucks to load with which items to move to different stores. So the whole thing is a very complex web. Your thesis is that web looks good, looks robust, but may not be that robust.
Right. Outwardly, it looks quite resilient, but it isn't. What we have is incredibly long chains of supply. And you mentioned Walmart stores. Well, could you imagine what life will be in a Walmart parking lot on the day that there's a federal government shutdown of all the SNAP cards? That's the digital replacements they have now for food stamps. That could be turned off at the flick of a switch. I wouldn't even feel safe in a Walmart parking lot on that day, much less feel comfortable walking inside, buying a cartload of groceries, and trying to walk out to my vehicle with it. There's a lot of interdependence and a lot of just plain dependence that is going to come back and bite us someday.
Well, now I think we had a local example, which hopefully you've tracked and you can talk to us about, because I think there's some great lessons there. Superstorm Sandy came along. And there was a whole chunk of New Jersey and that associated region that went without power for quite a bit of time. Were there any lessons to be learned there?
Well, yes, Superstorm Sandy was instructive in a lot of ways. First, it showed us that there's weather-related events that can have wide-reaching effects, far beyond just the specific area that's impacted by a storm. Because when supplies have to be trucked in for hundreds or even thousands of miles and those systems break down, if the reordering systems for retailers are disrupted, then store shelves don't get restocked. Even if the 18-wheel trucks can roll, if the Kanban inventory control systems are not functioning because of a lack of grid power in any at either end of a supply chain, you can have absolute chaos, and store shelves could be cleaned out overnight.
And certainly we saw that, and also with fuel. Fuel was a big issue there. Obviously, you know, we saw the lines of people trying to get a few extra gallons for their generators, very difficult to come by. And so my observation from that is I know a lot of people were really quite unnerved by that. And the next 2 weeks after that storm were really motivated to work on their preparations. And, you know, here we are a year later, and we'll find that most of that passion has dissipated. Is this something you
right.
see a lot?
Yeah, there. Like, for example, even the government attempts to correct a situation turned out to be counterproductive. In the case of Superstorm Sandy, the state of New York had their government come up with the brilliant idea of giving away gasoline to anyone who walked up to a gas station. Well, that caused all kinds of problems. Not only did you have fights breaking out in gasoline lines, you also had people attempting to get gasoline in containers that were far from safe. I mean, they were essentially walking around with Molotov cocktails. That situation could have spun completely out of control. And we literally could have seen fights that degenerated into flame wars. And I'm not talking internet flame wars. I'm mm-hmm. talking physical flame wars.
Well, now, to shift gears a bit, the media and perhaps yourself describes you as a survivalist. And for many, that conjures up an image of militant hermits hunkering down in bunkers in the depths of the wild. At Peak Prosperity, we focus on helping people develop resiliency, which does mean becoming more self-sufficient, but for most people also includes investing in relationships, having a valued, productive role in your community. How do you define your mission?
Well, I try not to get caught up in semantics, and people attempt to distinguish between, say, preppers and survivalists. Mm-hmm. I actually use the terms interchangeably. My mission in life is to try to motivate as many families as possible to get prepared. And I look at community resilience basically from the ground up. The fewer families that aren't prepared, the better. Basically, every family that's not prepared around me, I look at as part of the problem. And every family that is prepared, I look at as part of the solution. And every family that prepares represents, that prepares is one less family that's going to be rushing to the grocery store at the 11th hour. So all those families are going to be, again, part of the solution, not part of the problem. I'm a big believer in community sustainable agriculture, farmers markets, local currencies, all of that. And I come from a right-of-center perspective. So I have a lot in common with the left-of-center Birkenstock-wearing crowd. I'm just a little more heavily armed.
Well, it's a great description. Both of our sites serve people looking to become more prepared for this uncertain future that we both share. I think we see that. And in fact, the most common question we're asked by those who view the crash course is, well, what should I do? Many people are just really stumped at that first level of that first question. What foundational skills and preparations do you think are most important for the average individual to start on and develop?
Well, I guess the the most important, of course, is water filtration. I think that's crucial because if you look across the board at all the potential disasters, whether they're natural or man-made, one of the common denominators is the interruption of utility water supplies, public utilities. And even for people who live out in the country who are on well water, most families might even have a backup generator, but usually it's a 120-volt backup generator, and they have a 220-volt well pump, and they're going to be out of luck. So water is absolutely crucial. And water filtration, in case you have to gather water from open sources, whether it's from your own roof downspouts or from ponds or lakes or streams. The other issues that go out in concentric rings from there are all pretty well addressed in a link that I have on my website. Again, it's survivalblog.com. If you go in the left-hand bar and you click on List of Lists, it pretty well runs through all the major areas that people need to consider and budget for and budget their time for training. That web page, like everything else at my website, is completely free of charge, and I strongly encourage take a look at that List of Lists page and think seriously about their own particular situation. There is no one-size-fits-all solution because people are at different stages of life. They live in different climate zones. They have different family and work situations, different health situations. A lot of people suffer from chronic illnesses. So no two lists are going to be alike. People have to tailor their own lists to their own particular needs. And my approach is to work at it systematically. Set a budget, cut out all non-essential expenses, sell your jet ski and your HDTV, and get serious about this. Stock up, train up, and team up with your neighbors.
Oh, absolutely on taking this seriously, and I love this List of Lists. I have it open here. You've got a list of things on the barter and charity list. There's a book list, communications monitoring list, farm animals, financial prep list, firearms, first aid, minor surgery. So it's got all the basics right there. Now let me throw you a graduate level question. Then a friend of mine just happened to have been in Colorado a couple weeks ago. He was there during the floods. And he had his water filtration equipment with him. He happened to have been on a 4-day survival quest, and he was out there. So he was out there, and what he found was that these little tiny clear creeks that he had stepped over became 40 yards wide, raging torrents, and it was just covered full of that red clayish substance that passes for soil out there. And his water filtration just absolutely clogged up and couldn't handle whatever particulates were in the water. So there he was, surrounded
right.
by water.
Yeah. He needed
was tricky.
To use a pre-filter. And what he should have done was taken off his shirt, taken off his undershirt, redressed, and used that undershirt for a pre-filter. With a pre-filter, you can make any filter last much, much longer when you have high turbidity of water. If you have cloudy water, the very best thing you can do is use a pre-filter. And just a couple of layers of a t-shirt or one layer of a terry cloth towel is all you really need.
Yeah, he said he tried his shirt. It didn't work all that well, but because it was just the particulate was just that fine. So that was he felt a little chagrined. He wished he'd brought coffee filters along. He thought those might have done the trick.
Yeah, and of course, your body can handle particulates as long if you. If you just simply bring water to near a boil to kill the bugs, it doesn't even have to hit a full boil. It just has to be up close to a boil, up in the 180, 190 degree range. You're going to kill all the bugs. Your body, in fact, you'll probably get some really good nutrients from all that silt. So even if you have a situation where a water filter clogs up, you can always revert to Plan B, which is not boiling, but bringing water near a boil, or you can treat water with chlorine. And that, again, is described in my blog.
All right, fantastic. Well, another question that follows up, what should I do for people at our site is, where should I live? And I know that I chose where I lived based on a number of criteria that satisfied me. And you've written several detailed publications on this topic and offer regular consultations, too, to people trying to address that question. Well, the answer, I'm sure, is really tailored to the goals of individuals in each case. Could you just walk us through some of the key considerations that someone looking to relocate should consider? And
sure.
Maybe some of your favorite regions, too.
I think the key issue for me, given my perspective on preparedness, is population density. If people have the opportunity to move to a lightly populated region, I highly recommend that they do so. Fewer people means fewer problems. And regardless of the nature of a disaster, whether it's man-made or natural, if you're in a lightly populated region, odds are you're going to have fewer problems. You're certainly not going to have any big riots out in the middle of the hinterboonies like where I live. So I would put population density at the very top of my list.
Mm-hmm.
Another key consideration for picking up a piece of property would be the local economy. You want to have a diverse local economy that's predominantly agricultural, and you want to be in an area with plentiful water, and preferably in an area with predominantly hydroelectric power, because hydroelectric power is the most resilient. And as I described in my blog, I wrote an article entitled Islands in the Darkness, and I was talking about the contingency plans that many power utilities have for cutting themselves off of the national grid in the event that the national grids go down. There's actually three grids, the Western grid, the Eastern grid, and the Texas grid. If one of those grids were to go down, a lot of utilities that are in power exporting areas will be able to island themselves and their customers. For example, where I live, there are several major hydroelectric dams within 30 miles of me. And if the grids were to go down, within less than a minute, they could reconstitute an island of power for all of the people in our power co-op, for example. Another region that's quite good for that was described in my novel, Survivors. I set that in the area of Farmington, New Mexico, which is a natural gas producing area. And they, too, are a power exporter because they not only have a large coal-fired plant in northern Arizona, there's also, in the Four Corners region, a tremendous amount of natural gas that's produced, and they, too, export power. So, ideally, you want to be in a lightly populated area, an agricultural area, an area with plentiful water, preferably with shallow well depth, or even better yet, spring water, where you have gravity flow water to a house, and, again, a power exporting area. Those will be the safest places to be if everything falls apart, and if we have a major grid-down whammy, a multi-generational whammy, I couldn't think of a better place to be than someplace like that. Everywhere else in the country, there is going to be a substantial die-off of population. I certainly wouldn't want to be on the East Coast. I certainly wouldn't want to be in any of the major cities or near them. Nor would I want to be on a natural line of drift out of a major city. I've often have people ask me about the Central Valley of California since it's so agricultural, but it's so close to major population centers like the Los Angeles Basin and the San Francisco Bay Area. I think the Central Valley is just going to get overrun. So even if you had a farm in the Central Valley, you might not be safe.
So besides not the Central Valley for that reason, what regions then sort of float to the top of your list on that set of criteria?
Well, there's quite a few good ones. I actually like what I refer to as the American Redoubt region, which refers to Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and the eastern half of both Oregon and Washington. That, I think, is probably the safest area. But there's others that are quite good. There's places in the Dakotas that I would consider safe. The Four Corners region, where New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Colorado come together. There's also some areas like southwestern Oregon are quite good. There's a few places back east that I would consider, but there you run into a population density problem. So even in the Ozarks or in the hills of eastern Tennessee, you kind of have the illusion of being out in the boonies, but when the overall population density is 50 or 60 people per square mile for a state, eventually trouble's going to come looking for you. I would much rather live where I do, where the population density is only 3 people per square mile.
Hmm. So let me ask you a question, which I get, I'll form in a question, but I get this idea from people, which, and these might be very successful investment banker types or somebody, or people with a lot of money who say, oh, I'm concerned about this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to buy a place. I'll call it a hidey hole, but these might be really elaborate, beautiful places with, you know, fully tricked out, very wonderful places. But the idea is that they'll have this place and that in a crisis, they'll get to it and start living there if that's what circumstances call for. Would you say that's a reasonable strategy or not?
Well, it's not a very viable strategy. People really need to live at their retreats year-round and get into a self-sufficient lifestyle. You can't just buy survival. There's a learning curve to all of this. You need to learn. I mean, you can buy a wood cook stove, but that doesn't mean you know how to really cook with a wood cook stove or bake with it. There's a learning curve there. The same for gardening. It takes years, really, to develop soil, to build up your multi-year crops, and your berries, for example. Asparagus beds take years to develop. Fruit and nut trees take years to grow to maturity. You really have to be there. You have to learn the peculiarities of your local climate and your local, you know, your local frost-free days for growing. You have to learn which particular crops grow well in your climate zone. There's a learning curve to all of that. And unless you really live it, you can't just expect to, you know, show up at your retreat at the 11th hour and then start gardening the next day. It's probably not going to happen, at least not the way that people hope it will.
Well, Jim, I think there's one other piece in there, too, which all that's excellent observations. And the thing I notice that I think people from big cities have this myth of anonymity, like because you can be very anonymous in a big city, you know, surrounded by people. And the myth goes, I think that there's an idea that you can buy a place in the country and people won't really know about it. And my experience.
No, that's a myth. There, in the country, the population density may be low, but all the neighbor kids wander all over the countryside with their 22s out shooting small game all the time. You know, they know where every house is. And for that matter, looters can follow power lines to just about everywhere, or they're going to follow roads. So unless you buy an insanely remote property, someone's going to know that it's there. So survival is all about friends that you can trust and neighbors that you can trust. You can't do it on your own. And anyone who hopes to do it on their own, I think, is foolish. Community can be as close as just, you know, two or three neighbors, you know, on contiguous parcels, but it's still community. And that you need those people that you can count on. And let me tell you, as a former military officer, I've done continuous operations where we've had to maintain security 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And that was with a platoon size unit. I mean, and these are all young, fit people, and even we got worn out. To think that one family is going to maintain 24/7, 365 day a year, 360 degree perimeter security for an extended period of time is ludicrous. It's just not going to happen. You're going to burn yourself out within a few days. You really need neighbors that you can count on. You need a neighborhood watch on steroids.
Well, I think you've described me. I would last at least 2 days, 48 hours. I'd give myself a good 48 hours of constant vigilance, and then I'd get sloppy. So, Jim, talk to me about. So, you've been in this for a while, and I think you've got your finger on the pulse. So, and my question is,
How many people are beginning to think this way? And have you noticed any increase, decrease in the amount of interest? And most importantly, the people who are really concretely taking steps to move to these areas?
Well, I think it's indicative that most of the gun shows in the country are now morphing into preparedness expos. People recognize that it takes more than guns to survive. They need the whole package. They need photovoltaics. They need advanced first aid skills. They need communications equipment. They need water purification. They need food storage. They need non-hybrid gardening seed. There's so much that goes into it. People are definitely catching on. And right now, you can find a preparedness expo going on just about every weekend of the year within a couple hundred-mile driving radius. 4 years ago, that would have been impossible. They just didn't exist. So there's definitely a lot of people catching on, a lot of people coming up to speed very quickly. And I think the urgency of this is higher than ever, because we live in very perilous times. Just economically alone, if you look at what's going on with quantitative easing, they're attempting to reinflate a bubble right now. And as soon as the interest rates get away from Ben Bernanke and company, the game is over. Once interest rates rise a couple of percentage points, they won't be able to carry on their charade any longer, and we're going to see a collapse that will make the 2008 collapse look small by the comparison. So it's very important that people get prepared as quickly as they can. Time is short, and teamwork is crucial.
I do agree with that. You know, all that rising interest rates finally do for us is expose that we're insolvent and turn it into bankruptcy. And we've been living beyond our means, and rather than squaring up to that, we've just got I'll put quotes around these word leaders who are just interested in papering everything over to keep it going a bit longer. I understand their motivations. I totally disagree that they've got it right or they're going to be able to pull this off. So what we need then is to help people get a narrative, and under the story that we have isn't working. I think that's why we see the increased interest in things like preparedness expos, number of people who are concerned about stuff. Heck, I'll even go darker. The reason that suicides are now a leading cause of death overtaking car accidents, as recently as 2010, that was true. So all of these are indicators of stress. And that stress for me largely exists because the story we're telling ourselves, oh, look, the Dow's at all-time new highs, everything's fine, doesn't square up with our reality. And so we need a new narrative to step into. I think it's that simple. New stories. And sometimes it's exactly a story or a novel that helps us frame that. I hear you got a new book in the pipeline. In fact, maybe you could pre-order it. I looked on Amazon and saw that, called Expatriates, A Novel of the Coming Global Collapse. Can you tell us a little bit about what's in that book?
Sure. It's another novel in my Patriot series, but it's a little bit of a departure since there's no crossover characters with the previous novels. It's set in the same near-future time period with a global socioeconomic collapse. But in this case, I chose to focus on some Americans living abroad, some expatriates, in particular a missionary family living in the Philippines and a young Texas oil engineer living in northern Australia. And I wanted this opportunity to show some people that weren't quite as well prepared as some of the folks in my previous novels, people who have to improvise just about everything to assure their survival. And I wanted to show the uncertainty of, in particular, people living overseas, living in a foreign culture, being cut off from communication, not really knowing what's going on other than the fact that everything was falling apart and there's no transport back to the United States. And showing those type of characters gave me an opportunity to illustrate a number of tactics and techniques and technologies for survival. I hope folks enjoy it.
Well, it's very timely. We get a lot of questions by people who are wondering, should I stay or should I go? Meaning, do they prepare here or do they become expats in the hope that things will be better elsewhere? Were you meaning to cast a light on your view of expatriation in general?
Well, yeah, I think I did that a bit in the novel. But just to clarify, I don't recommend an expatriate lifestyle for people who are preparedness-minded unless you have very close family relationships in a foreign country. even if you were to move to an English-speaking country like Belize, for example, you're still going to be the new guy. You're going to be the gringo. You may be the expendable new guy in the minds of the locals, unless you have a tie to the local society. You need to either marry into a family or already have close relations one way or the other with someone who's been there for many, many years. Otherwise, I don't consider it very tenable. Yes, there are advantages to being in a society, a third world culture, where people are used to power failures all the time, but those economies are actually, you know, fairly fragile. And in a lot of places, especially island nations, the populations have outstripped the local resources, so that without importing large quantities of food and fuel, those island nations really won't be tenable in a collapse. They'll actually be very undesirable places to be, maybe perhaps quite dangerous places to be, if they're not truly self-sufficient or can't revert to self-sufficiency very quickly.
I completely agree on that point. And I'm looking forward to reading Expatriates, because you're a good writer. And I think that the novel format is a great way to really illustrate the reality of the situation. It's one thing to sort of imagine how we might manage a future situation. It's quite another to plunk yourself down into a scenario and then really think through all the details, because the military says no plan ever survives first contact with the enemy. Mike Tyson says everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face. However you put that, there's always a lot of learnings that happen when you get into a real situation. And so that's why I just really want to reiterate that I'm looking forward to reading Expatriates. People should look to read that. And if they haven't read the Patriot series, they're really very good at painting a vision of what a future might look like and the realities involved in actually being prepared and what's involved there. So, Jim, I really want to thank you for your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Chris. Of course,
survivalblog.com, you've just loaded with really helpful, practical information for people who want to become more prepared. So let's hope that we can spur a few families with this podcast to move down preparedness, because I'd much rather personally live next to a prepared family than an unprepared family.
Well, thank you once again, Chris, and I want to wish blessings to all of your listeners. I pray Psalm 91 for all of them.
Thank you so much, and you have a great day, and hope we can do this again sometime, Jim.